Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. So now we know, now we all know, one of the best-kept secrets in American political history. Deep Throat, it turns out, was the number two man at the FBI, Mark Felt. That means it was Felt who, as the anonymous government insider back in 1972 and 73, helped steer the Washington Post through its Watergate coverage. The stories from that time exposed the White House cover-up of a plot to steal political information, and it all led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. The editor in charge of that investigative work was Ben Bradley. A few months back, he talked with The Connection about the link between Deep Throat and Post reporter Bob Woodward.
People forget what kind of information he got from Deep Throat. It wasn't, go to the third shelf and pick out the sixth book and inside there will be a message. It was, don't waste your time on such and such a thing. Go look for the money. It was tremendously useful. These were two 29-year-old kids and an editor who was older but not much wiser, groping. And people were lying to us all over the pack. And the Nixon administration people, including presidential candidates like George Bush Sr., who was head of the Republican National Committee, and Bob Dole and those people, were raising hell with us about that.
So Deep Throat, or Mark Felt, is now in failing health and living in California. His family and friends say that even now he agonizes over whether he did the right thing. We'd like to have your thoughts this hour, first with your reaction on just what it means to have this mystery solved, but also to talk about where the legacy of Watergate and anonymous sources has brought us today. Did Watergate and Deep Throat lead us to cleaner politics, better journalism, or quite the reverse? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have a number of people who will be joining us through the hour. My first two guests include Chuck Colson. Chuck was special counsel to President Richard Nixon during the Watergate era. His own involvement led him to being charged and convicted for obstruction of justice in 1974. He served 7 months in prison. Since then, he's become a born-again Christian and founded the Prison Fellowship Ministries, which he runs today. He's joining us on the line. Mr. Colson, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And joining us from Washington is NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore, in case anyone needs reminding that there were other reporters working on this story. Dan was the Watergate reporter for CBS Television News. He won 3 Emmys for his coverage and wound up on President Nixon's enemies list. He's joining us from Washington. Dan, it's good to have you with us as well.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Let me start with you, Dan, if I can, just in terms of looking back. What does it tell us about that moment to know now that the person feeding the information was such a senior person at the FBI?
Well, I guess what it shows us is that you cannot count on anybody nowadays in government not to leak. And a good thing, too, if I may add an editorial note to that, very few people would have thought that the associate director of the FBI would have gone for a game like that. So it really is quite startling in his way.
And Chuck Colson, did the people close to the president know at the time that it was Mark Felt who was doing that leaking?
I certainly didn't, and I dealt with Mark often and had great confidence in him, and I figured anyone holding a position that sensitive would never disclose it. You know, you got to remember, I went to prison for disclosing. The reason that I was charged with obstruction of justice and ended up in prison was disclosing an FBI file to a reporter. So for the FBI assistant director, the deputy director, to be disclosing secrets to the Washington Post, I was shocked, and I'm kind of disappointed. I think it's really sad note for Mark Felt personally, who I think was a very distinguished public servant, to end up, 91 and in failing health, and he'll be remembered not for his distinguished public service, but for being Deep Throat. I think it's kind of sad.
And you think
I think.
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Sorry. I think that it was a part of his distinguished public service to have been Deep Throat.
And well, Dan and I would disagree on that, but we've disagreed on things over the years, so that's okay.
Yes, we have.
I would disagree with that simply because I don't think the end justifies the means. If it did, I wouldn't have gone to prison. He may have served a noble end in bringing down the Nixon presidency, but a more honorable way to have done it would have been to have walked into the office of the FBI director and say, we got to go see the president because he's doing this and his staff are doing that. If they had come into Nixon's office, into the Oval Office, I can guarantee you Nixon would have straightened the mess out, not because he was a great, virtuous man, but because his own self-interest would have been at stake. If he thought the FBI knew this kind of stuff, he would realize they could bring him down. So I think Mark Felt could have stopped Watergate, which would have then he would have been a hero.
Let me add a bit of history here. And this comes from the Oval Office tapes, which are being released, a large chunk of them every few years or so. And this one, October 19, 1972, was the day that Nixon himself found out who Deep Throat was. And he says to Haldeman, "Well, if they got a leak down to the FBI, why the hell can't Gray tell us?" Gray was L. Patrick Gray, who was nominated to be the FBI director. "Why can't he tell us what the hell is..." "You know what I mean, Haldeman? We know what's left, and we know who leaked it." "Nixon, somebody in the FBI?" Haldeman, "Yes, sir, Mark Felt. You can't say anything about this because it will screw up your source as a real concern. Mitchell is the only one who knows about it, and he feels strongly that we better not do anything because..." Nixon, "Do anything? Never?" Haldeman, "If you move on him, he'll go out and unload everything. He knows everything that's to be known in the FBI. He has access to absolutely everything." Nixon, "What would you do with Felt?" Haldeman, "Well, I asked Dean..." I could go on with this because it's quite fascinating, but I think we probably want something
later.
Let
me just go back to Chuck Colson for a moment here. Are you saying, Chuck, that it was that what Felt did, passing information on about the Nixon White House, was perhaps morally the right thing to do, but it was his methods that you quarrel with?
Well, I think it was not morally the right thing to do. I would be scared to death if we lived in a country where the deputy director of the FBI could release anybody's file at will, and we'd call it a noble act. I don't know where the ACLU is these days, but I'd certainly be screaming about that. I personally am offended by that idea, and it remains so today, regardless of his justification for doing it. But the tape Dan just read absolutely makes my point. Nixon was scared to death that the FBI had the goods on him. If they had walked in his office, Mark Felt and Pat Gray, who was a very honorable guy, and said, "Mr. President, this stuff going on in here, we got to stop this because it's going to destroy your presidency," he would have stopped it because he would have been afraid not to. So my only point, and who knows in hindsight what would have happened, but my only point is the honorable thing to do would have been look the president in the face and say, "You're breaking the law, and I'm going to see that justice is done," and the president would have responded, and if he hadn't, Mark Felt could go out and hold a press conference on the steps of the White House and expose it, and that would have been the end of it.
Chuck, I was a pretty young man at the time, but my recollection of that period of time was the president, in effect, waded in deeper and deeper and deeper, and at some point, he was so far in that it would have been almost impossible for him to have, you know, taken the information, turned around and said, "Yes, you're right, I need to make a clean slate of things."
Not in October. In October of 1973, he still had a chance to get out of it easily by cooperating with Archibald Cox, who was still a Watergate prosecutor, having a press conference and saying, "Look, I've discovered what's really going on here. I'm going to clean it up."
He
could have. Beyond that, no. After that, it became too impossible. But you're right. You gradually slide into conspiracies and you gradually get in over your head. But who cares about what happened to Deep Throat all these years later? I mean, I don't think it's an inside the Beltway story.
I'm not too sure about that. I want to take a call from Burlington, Vermont. Robert's joining us on the line. Robert, you think this is an inside the Beltway story?
Hardly. I was 18 years old approximately at this time. I was just getting out of high school, and it was just an amazing thing, almost like the election of 2000, just where we were seeing our country taken from us, and Nixon himself didn't care. Mr. Colson, expression of the immorality of Deep Throat to do what he did is just doesn't hold water. What Mr. Felt did was actually serve the country at great risk to himself, when the government itself, to the very highest level, the president himself, was corrupt to the core, and there was. And he had power, a lot of power. You know, there is no way that he could have gone on this done this overboard. He had to do it underhand.
Let me, Robert, get a response to that from Chuck Colson.
Well, I think you're arguing the end justifies the means, and I don't believe that. And I've given my life the last 30-some years to working as a Christian in the prisons, and I sure wouldn't advise that to anybody who's anybody coming along in life today. Don't follow this. It's not a good example. But the second question, which nobody seems to want to deal with, because, and I understand why the press wouldn't. The press lives on anonymous sources, sometimes to its detriment, as we've seen in the last year. But the fact of the matter is that do you really want an FBI deputy director, for whatever his noble motives, to feel that he can release information that's basically been considered sacred over the years, held in FBI files? I don't. I don't want to live in that kind of a country.
And that is precisely where we will take this conversation as we look at what the legacy of Watergate and Deep Throat have done for American politics and American journalism. Chuck Colson, I want to thank you for spending a few moments with us. Good to hear from you.
I was happy to do it.
Chuck Colson is now founder of the Prison Fellowship Ministries, and he was among those who served jail time in the aftermath of the Watergate affair. Dan Shore will stay with us for the balance of the hour. We want to hear from you, 1-800-423-8255. We could spend the hour talking about just what it means to have this mystery solved. We do want to look ahead, though, look at what Watergate has taught us, what changed. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. We now know that it was the man who was number two at the FBI in 1972-1973, a man by the name of Mark Felt, who was Deep Throat, the man who was passing information and giving confirmation to the Washington Post in their coverage of the Watergate scandal at that time. Dan Shore is with us from our Washington Bureau. He's senior news analyst for NPR. And Dan, we're going to join a couple of other guests in just a minute, but first I want to hear your answer to the second question posed there by Chuck Colson. Do we want the number two person at the FBI leaking stuff, passing files to the press? What do you think?
Well, I have to give a very personal answer, and I may as well tell you that. The FBI, on the orders of President Nixon, investigated me, hoping to learn something about me which they could use to my disadvantage. If you've been on the outside and you learn that the president will use the FBI, and in fact it was one of the counts in the bill of impeachment against Nixon, was his abuse of power and using the FBI to investigate a reporter, then obviously my view of this will be quite different from Chuck Colson's view of it. He retains his loyalty. I respect that. What I retain is that you can be very scared at what these agencies can do, and if there is somebody inside willing to play whistleblower, I believe that that is helping to preserve our republic.
You're talking about the investigation of the Intelligence Investigating Committee when you published a leaked copy. You were at that time not only investigated by the House Ethics Committee, but I think suspended by CBS and very nearly went to jail yourself for refusing to rat out a source.
Yes, Dick, but we're discussing two different episodes in
okay.
my checkered life.
what I'm
talking about is when they didn't like a report I had done on the air, and Nixon said, let's get this guy, call Hoover, and let's get something on him. And then there was an investigation that stopped when the thing got out that they were doing the investigation. And I looked at that and said, suppose I found something. Suppose the FBI had broken into my house and gotten something on me. Mm-hmm. Do I hope that there'll be somebody there to blow the whistle? Yes, I do.
Let's bring in two more guests. Geneva Overholser is chair in public affairs reporting at the Missouri School of Journalism and former ombudsman for the Washington Post. Has been with us before in Geneva. It's nice to have you back again.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
And Daniel Okrent is joining us from Wellfleet, Massachusetts. He is former public editor of the New York Times. Just still catching your breath from that job. Daniel, thanks for being with us.
Sure. How are you, Dick?
I'm well. Can I ask you to begin with this? Because both of you have been thinking and writing recently about the use of anonymous sources in journalism. How do you trace this back, Daniel, to Watergate and what kind of a link do you make now?
Well, I think there is one. I think that what Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein did then, which is truly great reporting and very important to the democracy, to the republic, kind of glamorized a kind of reporting that had not yet become every day at every newspaper and every broadcast outlet. And a generation of reporters came into the industry wishing to be like Woodward and Bernstein, or even better, to be like Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford, who played them in the movie. And I think that you can trace the growth of the use of anonymous sources really from that time, and it's really ballooned since then.
To an overuse of anonymous sources?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the critical thing that you have to remember, that we all need to remember, is that anonymous sources are, as Dan Short said, they're absolutely necessary for certain kinds of reporting. But I think that the two standards that need to be applied are very clear. One, is there any other way of knowing this? Can we get this on the record? And two, is it really important what we are learning? And I think that the second rule especially is breached every day in every American newspaper.
Geneva, this is exactly what you ran into when you started work at the Washington Post. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I kept being told that I was just silly to worry about this. You know, it must be because I came out here from Iowa. People call me Prairie Marm. And I kept writing about it and writing about it, and people would come sit in my office, including Woodward, who said, you know, look, we're careful and people trust us, but it's become quite evident that people don't, and that we do real damage by an overuse of anonymous sources. We let people speak without holding them accountable for what they're saying. We let people insult one another. There was a story in the Washington Post yesterday morning in which an anonymous Republican was quoted as saying, you know, that Bush has squandered his political capital and he has a 10-year. I mean, this is totally unfair to let people malign others and not have their name attached to it. And yet, even with the strengthened codes that exist today, this happens in our best newspapers.
Dan Chork, talk to me a little bit about this generation of reporters spawned by the Watergate thing. I see it in kind of two ways, a generation of really good investigative reporters and then a generation of sort of Watergate wannabes, people who were just in the business of trying to, you know, get somebody, get famous. Do you see it the same way?
Yes, in some ways I do. As I used to go speaking at colleges, universities in the years after Watergate, after Nixon had gone, inevitably a question would arise, how can I be like Woodward and Bernstein? And the whole of our journalism was colored by trying to repeat the feat of journalism that those two had performed. And time again, I have to say, there's one Watergate in each generation. You can't have it happen every week and every year. Mm. What you must learn is that there are other kinds of investigative reporting into what's going on in the mayor's office, the welfare office, and not think in terms of everything is Woodward Bernstein. They put their mark on a generation of young journalists, not always for the good.
Let's take a call from Dartmouth, Massachusetts. John's joining us from there. John, what do you think?
Oh, well, thank you for having me. You know, I was listening, and it's interesting what one of your guests said. I think that Deep Throat, as an anonymous source, made Woodward and Bernstein, he gave them hints so that they could prove what he was saying. And I like that he kind of ignited passion like a good teacher. And with anonymous sources, it's like the problem I have with the Valerie Plame case now. An anonymous source, you just can't say it and then let it go and say, well, that must be true and not follow up on it. And if it's something that is a real whistleblower, that is like you can look at it and say, is our country getting better from this or is it being hurt? And I can say with Watergate, preceded by the Pentagon Papers, our country was being hurt by this administration the further it went into secrecy. Yet you look at something like Valerie Plame, where, what was it, 5 out of the 6 journalists chose not to listen to the anonymous source or the whistleblower on blowing a CIA agent. So I'm all for it, and they should be protected, but everything verified.
Let me, if I just can, remind our listeners, Valerie Plame is the former CIA agent who was outed, presumably by someone in fairly high office, because she was the wife of Joseph Wilson, another person who was involved in the study of weapons of mass destruction back in that flurry of the run-up to the war with Iraq. And in fact, there are two journalists, Judith Miller at the New York Times and Matt Cooper at Time, who still could, in fact, face jail time for their own involvement in that. Dan O'Krent, how does anybody ever know if the use of the anonymous source is a good thing or a bad thing? Here we are 32, 33 years after Watergate, still scratching our head over this one.
Oh, I'm not scratching my head over that one. I think that it was because of the reporting that Woodward and Bernstein did that the Nixon administration's malfeasance were made public. That was absolutely great reporting,
okay.
And it came to a great result.
But Geneva, in the moment, how do you know?
Right. At the time, plenty of people thought it wasn't great reporting and that it was dangerous for the Republic. I think that the standards that Dan O'Krent has mentioned are exactly right. You can't really know what people will think in 32 years, but if the editor and the reporter confront those two questions especially, is it vital for the Republic to know this? I mean, we don't have to decide for people. The people are the ones who govern themselves, right? Is it important that they know this? And is this the only way we can get it? Then later you let Time vote on whether it was a leaker who was doing God's work or somebody else's work. The fact is, it's not up to us to decide. It is important for us, however, to think about the intentions of the leaker. In the case of the Valerie Plame story, the intentions were really, I think, to turn the whole whistleblowing thing on its head, you know, to bring retribution down on the whistleblower. So, of course, reporters should think carefully about what it is they're being used as an agent of, and that's one of the dangers of anonymous sources. We also need to tell our readers or viewers or listeners as much as we possibly can about anonymous sources and also about their motivation, because we are robbing our news consumers of an ability to judge if we don't do that. But all of this aside, we really have to understand that the overuse of anonymous sources cheapens the coin, which is bad, particularly because we've got to protect this absolutely essential tool. I think all of us agree on that. There is no absolutism here.
Dick, and good morning, Geneva.
Good morning, Dan. How are you?
Fine. Let me pose this question. Suppose there had never been a Deep Throat, a Mark Felt to do this thing. What do you think would have happened in history if Nixon had been able to go unimpeded to where he wanted to go, which in the first place to sort of send commissars to all the government departments, centralize authority in his hands, and really make life difficult for this whole country? We were saved from that in some part because there was somebody high up. I can tell you what Mark Fell's motivations were. First of all, he was very angry because he'd been passed over to succeed as director of the FBI on the death of J. Edgar Hoover. He didn't like that. And secondly, as a stalwart FBI person, he was worried that the cover-up of Watergate would make the FBI investigation look very bad. And those were two pretty good reasons for a guy to do what he did. If he had not done so, if I could reconstruct that era, and Nixon, who was told by John Dean there was a cancer growing on the presidency, but didn't seem to mind it, paid off people for their silence. Can you imagine what this country would be like if there had not been a Deep Throat?
I quake to think, Dan, and I am very pleased that, in fact, those courageous reporters and their very courageous editor and publisher were willing to do this, and I think it was in the public interest. And I think this reminder that anonymous sources not only are essential but can even be heroic comes at a perfect timing, because we've been agonizing so much about what has turned into a sort of a profligacy of anonymous source usage.
Dick, if I may jump in here, I think one thing that's worth adding to what both Dan and Geneva have said, we need to make a distinction for people who are listening about what an anonymous source can be. Often an anonymous source gives you the tip that leads you in other directions where you can get confirmation on the record. And in fact, quite a bit of what came from Deep Throat, as I recall, turned out to be things that ended up being corroborated in other places. An enormous amount of journalism begins with an anonymous source, but then the responsible editor and the responsible reporter, they then go further with it, ascertain, A, that it's true, and, B, find people on the record who will confirm it.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see in the Woodward and Bernstein statement that came with the unveiling of Mark Felt, their comment that many other sources and officials assisted us on this. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Newton, Massachusetts, and Al's joining us. Hi, Al.
Good morning.
Tell me what you think.
Well, I think, in a sense, you guys are missing one of the points here. Because everybody's wrapped up in the anonymous source story, that's the central focus of the discussion you have today. But it really wasn't an issue in Watergate. If my memory is correct, the Bradley and the other two guys had a rule that nothing they got from Felt would be printed unless they had independent corroboration. And I believe they said they followed that all the way through to the end.
Is that right, Dan Schor? Did they double-source everything on that?
That's right. Yeah, well, at least Ben Bradley said no single source will do and everything has to be double-sourced. And at times, Bob Wood would come in and say he has a sensational story, and Ben would say, how many sources do you have on that? Go back and get another source. Yes, they did do that.
Okay, so Al, what's your point here?
So if that's the case, this might be worth discussing in terms of Watergate, only in the sense of how what is a responsible use of an anonymous source, and it's separate from the discussion generally of irresponsible use of anonymous sources. And I think it would be more interesting to get into what took place at that time and what part Mark Felt played and so on. I think you guys are just mixing up two points because you're preoccupied with the issue of irresponsible use of anonymous source. That didn't happen in the Washington Post reporting.
I think your point's well taken, Al. The issue that we're trying to focus on here is, you know, basically taking that anonymous source, Deep Throat, as the tip of the diving board here and seeing where it led journalism in its use of anonymous sources. I'm holding in my hand a letter that Richard Smith, chairman and editor-in-chief of Newsweek, sent to readers just last week, and this was in the big kerfuffle over the use of the story on the Koran, the accusation made that the copy of the Koran was in fact flushed down the toilet in Guantanamo, which was later retracted by Newsweek. There's a paragraph in here, Dan Okred, I just want to read it to you and get your reaction, in which he says, "We will raise the standards for the use of anonymous sources throughout the magazine. Historically, such sources have helped to break or advance stories of great national importance, but overuse can lead to distrust among readers and carelessness among journalists. As always, the burden of proof should lie with the reporters and the editors to show why a promise of anonymity serves the reader. From now on, only the editor or the managing editor or other top editors they specifically appoint will have the authority to sign off on the use of an anonymous source." Would that meet your test as public editor?
Well, I think that's a first test, but then you have to add the two things I said before. How important is this, and is there any other way of knowing it? You keep have to getting back to these kind of basic things, that procedures are secondary to principles when we're talking about reportorial ethics and what's good for journalism. I think that one of the things that happened in the Newsweek case, Newsweek acknowledged that the Periscope section of the magazine did not go through the same number of editors that other parts of the magazine did, that it was not checked as thoroughly. But there wasn't anything at the top of the page the Periscope is on that said, this is stuff we didn't check as thoroughly as the rest of the magazine. I think that everything in a publication or in a broadcast has to meet the same standard.
Geneva?
Well, what worries me is that almost every news organization now, although Newsweek did not, amazingly, has pretty powerful, strong, well-considered anonymous source usage policies in the media's ethical standards handbook or whatever. The question is whether or not they pursue them. I mean, you know, people have monitored the Washington Post or the New York Times since they instituted ever stronger anonymous source use principles, and they you know, thumb their noses at them all the time. So we not only have to have good policies, we have to pursue them and put them into practice. But one thing I think is important to note is it's not as if Watergate invented anonymous sources.
Right.
I mean, I'm not even sure we really, that we're accurate in saying they've ballooned since then. I think our concern about them has ballooned lately, which is terrific. But we've always had anonymous sources. Old newspapers constantly talked about high officials, you know, doing
right.
this and that.
Although the interesting thing was that this in one way may have broken that clubbiness and created a sort of separation. We can talk
yes.
a little bit more about that when we come back. Geneva and Daniel, I know you both have to go. I want to thank you both for being with us on this part
thank
of the program.
You,
thank you, Dick. So long.
Dan O'Krant, former public editor of the New York Times. Geneva Overholser is chair in public affairs reporting at the Missouri School of Journalism, Washington Bureau. Well, what about the legacy of Watergate? What about the legacy of Deep Throat? Now that we have the name, the puzzle looks a little clearer now. Does it give us any more guidance about how that time has directed politics and directed journalism in this country. Overall, is the effect a good one or a bad one? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour on the day after we learn the name of Deep Throat, a conversation about the legacy of Watergate, the legacy of anonymous sources, its effect on American politics and journalism. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Dan Shore is with us. He is senior news analyst for NPR. We're going to take a call from Tampa, Florida. Mrs. Jackson is joining us from there. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you loud and clear.
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh, great. I'd like to say, first of all, I'm very, like, excited to be able to talk to Daniel Shore. I really admire your commentaries on NPR, and I hope that you never shut up. I hope that the aura...
We try. You know, I have to tell you, Mrs. Jackson, we try to shut him up all the time, and he just keeps popping back up. Do you have a question for him?
Yes. Does he feel that the atmosphere around the current administration is parallel to the atmosphere of the Nixon administration at the time? And
are you talking about secrecy? Are you talking about relations with the press? What are you talking about specifically?
I'm talking about secrecy, relations with the press, and I'm talking about trying to shut people up. And one thing, does he see a connection between the Valerie Plame story?
Okay,
and
let's take the first one if we can. Dan, just the...
Well, I think it's a great question because I think that there's not been an administration that I can remember that has been so intent on and so successful at trying to cover information and keep it from getting out except in ways in which they had control of how they did it, whether it be by phony news reports on agriculture or education put on television stations. I don't think that even in the Nixon administration was there such an urge on their part to not let anybody know anything until and unless they were ready to reveal it, which means that the function of the reporter and the whistleblower becomes more important than ever.
But is it not, by some standards, a measure of success of the Bush administration that they are as skilled as they are at plugging leaks and keeping people on message, Dan?
Yes, they are very successful in plugging leaks and keeping control of the information to be released if and as and when they want to do that. If successful, yes. But great for America, no.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Boston, Ron's on the line. Hello, Ron.
Hi, Dick. What a pleasure it is to also ask a question of Dan Shore. This thought has occurred to me a couple of times, and it did again this morning listening to your discussion. It may sound a bit paranoid, but I'm wondering if it's possible to consider that this administration is setting up the press in, for example, with the Dan Shore Bush military story, where information might be passed through anonymous sources.
I'm not sure I'm following you here, Ron. What story are you talking about?
Well, when Dan Rather was handed the information about Bush's military record, and it was discredited because
Right.
then it was found out that it was actually printed on a computer and not on a typewriter at the day that would have been used in the day. In the Newsweek story, I wonder if there's a possibility that the administration, knowing about this anonymous source that the press uses, that somehow this administration is setting up the press.
It becomes pretty conspiratorial, doesn't it, Ron?
Well, you know, it only takes a few people to discredit the press, and these recent stories have really been rather alarming, and the press has taken a very serious hit. And it just occurred to me to ask the question, is it conceivable that the administration could be setting up the press in this way to then later discredit it?
Are you suggesting that the document, which turned out to be a forgery, had been forged by the administration in the Dan Rather case?
Not necessarily that, but they knew it was a forgery and sort of allowed it to be sent on to Dan and to Dan rather.
I don't think we're going to be able to answer that because we don't know. But I think that there is a larger point in here, Ron, and if you permit me to widen that up out a little bit, we have, Dan Shore, seen this administration take a pretty hard line with the press, with the media, when it comes to something like the Newsweek story.
Let me give you an example, which I thought illustrative of how this administration operates. A couple of years ago, we first saw the videotape of Osama bin Laden being distributed. And it was exciting because I hadn't seen the guy before, and this was a very grave danger. And so the television networks used quite big chunks of Osama bin Laden. Well, Condoleezza Rice, who was then National Security Advisor, arranged a conference call with four television news editors and told them that their use of this kind of material coming from such a source was unpatriotic and not good for this nation. And the result? All four began to cut back on their use of Osama bin Laden. I mean, that is the kind of thing they do, is to say that if you're against us, you're unpatriotic. Makes it a little tough, but it's a challenge.
I want to go back on, if we sort of take this same question back to the early days of Watergate, Dan. Could you make the case, could somebody make the case that because Mark Felt had his nose out of joint because he wasn't called in to replace J. Edgar Hoover at the head of the Bureau, that maybe he was just using the Washington Post as a way of getting back at the administration? And if you just sort of accept that construct for a minute, does that mean what he did was any less respectable or responsible?
There are two things to bear in mind. One is the motive of somebody for leaking something, and the second is the legitimacy of the leak itself. Yes, you can go into the motivations that animated Mark Felt, angry because he didn't see why L. Patrick Gray came from the outside, should be the successor to J. Edgar Hoover, and he had his motives. But the point is that whatever his motives were, the information in the end checked out and made an enormous difference. I can't, or in the days when I was being a reporter and not just a pundit, I could not spend a great deal of time saying, although I could sometimes imagine why somebody was telling me something, but it didn't alter the legitimacy of the information.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Sherry's with us. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. How's everybody doing?
We're well. Thanks for your call. What are you thinking today?
Well, my main comment is that I think more transparency, particularly political transparency, is healthy for this country rather than less. And Mr. Colson's assertion that the FBI, or at least what I got from it, was that the FBI is required to keep political secrets, I think is the wrong duty for the FBI. So I you know, of course, back Mark Felt, everything he did. And then I'd also like to say that...
Even if there's an oath of allegiance there to a commander-in-chief, right, Sherry?
Well, you know, I think the people of America are the real commander-in-chief. And I also think that, oddly, it just kills me that, because I'm a child of the 60s or was in college in the 60s, that I don't think that the main media, the network television especially, jumps on some of these stories that are coming out anything like they did in the 60s and 70s. There's some things that have come out that would have been major news for 3 or 4 months that barely get noticed. And I just wonder what's happening there.
So you're saying we are losing that transparency, Sherry, rather than moving in that direction?
Well, we certainly are with the Bush administration, and I think that if someone like Condoleezza Rice can call media networks and say, no, 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 that's not political, and people fall for it, that's not patriotic. I mean, something not cool is happening in this country. I mean, in the 60s, there was just so much investigation of everything that happened, and now, you know, like with the weapons of mass destruction thing that weren't there, and all these stories barely get touched.
Is it a shift, Dan Shore, that we have seen over time, or does it change with each administration?
Well, I think it changes some with each administration, and I think there's a kind of an apogee of control has been reached with this one. Of course, you go back to the Vietnam War when an assistant secretary of defense says that our job here is managing the news. At that time, that was considered to be very shocking that they decided that if it served their purpose, they would not give out information or give out information not necessarily correct. I guess that in every administration, the president said, what's my power for unless I can control the way the country views me, the way the country views what I'm doing? But then that is why there is a constant tension, and I think our founding fathers meant that there should be that tension between the president and his vast powers and the press and its not-so-vast powers.
You know, we have talked on this program about the way that the Watergate scandal and the deep throat, the use of deep throat in that reporting has changed journalism. We haven't spent as much time on how it's changed politics. David Gergen is joining us on the line now. He's former White House advisor, was in the Nixon White House, as well as working with a number of other presidents. He's currently director of the Center for Public Leadership at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. David, it's nice to have you back on the program.
Good morning. Glad to be here with Dan and with you.
What do you think when you look back now with that one missing piece of the jigsaw puzzle now in place? Are we any better able to say how politics in this country has changed as a result of that scandal and that time?
Well, the revelation of Mark Fowler's deep throat, I don't think has really changed our politics, but there's no question that that Watergate, accompanied by the deceptions of Vietnam and the loss in Vietnam, dramatically changed our politics.
You link the two, do you, in a way?
Absolutely. If you, in particular, in trust and government, trust in people's faith and those who serve, I think was dramatically changed. If you look at the data from public opinion polling, for example, while the polls in the 30s were very incomplete, but you can see a general upswing from the time Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932 up through the mid to late 60s of very high level, growing and then very high levels of faith in both the ethics and the efficacy of those who serve in government. And almost complete collapse after the late 60s, early 70s.
But are you saying that collapse is a good thing or a bad thing, David?
I think it's been a terrible thing. And I think we've paid a huge price for it. In that we have so little faith in the honesty and the capacity of those in government that we're very reluctant to experiment in ways that we might otherwise with social issues
Would you go so far as to say that we then should not have necessarily known all the details of the Watergate time, that the country should not have challenged the presidents over the U.S. commitment in Vietnam, that sort of thing?
Oh, no, not at all. I don't. I think that the challenge was absolutely right. I think we need to have complete ventilation. When people lie and break the law, you need to have a complete ventilation of that. Whether deep throat was the right way to do it, that's a separate issue. But there's no question that having congressional hearings, John Sirica and the court processes, and the Pentagon Papers ultimately served a very good purpose, and that was that they forced people to be accountable inside. But it did bring on. I think we have only the people in government to blame. You know, Mary McGrory used to argue, yes, the press is cynical, but if we're cynical, we have much to be cynical about.
But are you saying that deep throat then was a good thing or a bad thing for the body politic?
I believe that the aggressive reporting by the Washington Post was ultimately a good thing. I mean, I was in the inside of the Nixon administration.
Right.
I was one of those who was persuaded for a long time by others that I worked with that Richard Nixon basically didn't do a lot of this, that this was being trumped up by the Washington Post, and I think they turned out to be wrong. I think the Washington Post has been significantly vindicated on its reporting, especially Woodward and Bernstein and, of course, the editor of the publication. So I think all of that that's been helpful. On the particular question of whether Mark Felt, as a number two at the FBI, should have gone first to the Washington Post, I think that's a much more difficult question. We don't know the circumstances. There's some who want to rush and put a lay a wreath on his head and say he was a hero, and there are others who think he was a snake. I'm not sure we know enough.
Pat Buchanan said last night on television he was a traitor. Would you go that far?
No, I think Pat Buchanan specifically said he was not a traitor.
I missed that quote.
He said I would not call him a traitor. He did say it was a snake, but in his book, there's a difference. But the point of this is that I don't think we know enough of the context in which Mark Felt was operating to know if, in fact, he did do this out of conscience, or whether there were other motivations, whether he was trying to get even, or whether there was some vendetta that came out of the Hoover years.
This takes me back to what, Dan Schur, you were saying a little bit earlier, saying that the motivation may not, in fact, have been that important.
Well, it's not important in terms of the outcome. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, knowing it's interesting to know that Felt had hoped to be the successor to J. Edgar Hoover and didn't like it that an outsider, L. Patrick Gray, became the acting director. He never was confirmed, incidentally, acting director of the FBI. But as far as I'm concerned, the need for the information is very great. And if the person who gives it to me has some motive of his own, that's part of the game.
I agree. I have, from a journalistic standpoint, I think that's absolutely right. And Carl Bernstein and especially Bob Woodward, who met with Deep Throat, did not need to inquire deeply into the motives. I think that's absolutely right. But we're now getting into this game, which I hope will pass away pretty quickly, about whether Mark Felt should be regarded as a hero. And he is being treated in some quarters as this sort of, you know, a pure white sort of fellow. Well, it's worth remembering that this fellow was part and parcel of a Hoover operation, and he was indicted and then convicted for authorizing burglaries into private homes.
We just have a couple of seconds left in the program. I'm curious to know from both of you, is there a certain sort of letdown in finally knowing who the name of Deep Throat is, David?
Not at all. I think it's terrific. As someone who's been included in the long list of potential contenders, you can imagine I feel a certain amount of personal relief, but that's nothing compared to the larger public good that's served by all of us knowing far more than we do and remembering how abusive people could be in government unless checked. And I think that's a valuable lesson in civic democracy.
Dan,
I don't know what Al Haig is going to do, or John Dean is going to do, or Len Garman is going to do, now that we know that none of them was Deep Throat.
Dan Schur, I thank you for being with us on the program. It's always nice to hear from you. Dan Schur, senior news analyst for NPR. David Gergen, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
David's a former Nixon aide, now director of the Center for Public Leadership at the JFK School of Government. On this program, we talked with Chuck Colson, special counsel to the Nixon White House during the Watergate years, Geneva Oberholzer from the Missouri School of Journalism, and Daniel Okren, former public editor of the New York Times. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.